at the TechNet.
If you Google Net Chart, they have a CUDA rule. You can go to a CUDA rule reference there, and it's very good, extremely well documented and explained, and they also give you references to where you find other information on Smith Trot that was written up in a number of the periodicals. I just more or less came up with this here just to simplify basically the use of the Smith chart on simple vertical antennas or simple antennas, you know, just to give them an insight into it. This is a very small story of it, but just a way for them to experiment to get their so-called feet wet in using the Smith chart as an extremely valuable way of going ahead and, you know, doing measurements. In fact, you can almost do these measurements with even a simpler device than one of these handheld antenna analyzers. You can more or less use even a QRP rig in this way and measure the SWR and then apply it to the Smith chart. Stick over.
Yeah, there's a couple of good points there. One of them is that standing wave ratio tells you a good piece of information, but some of the information is missing. The real impedance you want to know about, what is your antenna doing to you? Is it too high? Is it too low? Is it capacitive or is it inductive? If you knew that information, it's a little bit like a blind man walking up a hill. You know which direction to go to make it better. But you could do it by cut and try and experiment, the Edisonian approach. Both approaches work. Depends on how much of a scientist you want to be. But knowing the impedance is at times very helpful, particularly if you're sweeping a lot of frequency and you want to know how to make a compensating network so your antenna is a little bit more broadband over a whole frequency region. So these antenna analyzers, I think in general they will give you magnitude of reflection signal. Your bird wants me to tell you that also. But the antenna analyzer also gives you phase angle. Once you know phase angle, that allows you to put a dot on the Smith chart. One of the things that Mel hasn't quite mentioned yet is that on that resistive axis, the horizontal axis, when the Smith chart is held right side up, let me drop. On that horizontal axis, the right-hand side of resistance, the extreme, is called infinity, and the far left-hand side is called zero. Infinity is where the phase angle of reflection is 0 degrees. You find the right outer markings on that Smith chart. There's a whole bunch of degree markings starting off on the right-hand side going clockwise. So the right-hand side is 0 degrees. The left-hand side is the first 90 degrees. You come back to the right-hand side again by going clockwise all the way. You come back to 180. Each 180 degrees, each half wavelength of cable repeats impedance. So if your AEA or your MFJ shows your reflection magnitude and phase angle, you can enter it on that Smith chart. And that tells you not only what you've got, but for various lengths of cable, what you're going to get. One of many things it can give you. There's all kinds of nomographs and whatever on the perimeter of that Smith chart. Properly used, an extremely useful tool. In a physical way, it shows you some tremendous mathematics. Because if you didn't have the Smith chart, let me drop, and somebody told you your antenna was 25 ohms resistance plus 25 ohms of inductive reactance, that alone doesn't tell you standing wave ratio. You could enter that piece of information onto the Smith chart, get a dot on the page, find out by putting that the pencil of your compass on that dot, putting the pivot of your compass in the center, and swinging the circle, you'll find out where it hits the horizontal axis on the right side, and it'll tell you standing wave ratio in one very simple operation. To do it mathematically, you have to take the real impedance as a complex number, R plus JX. You have to subtract 50 ohms from that and make that the numerator. Duplicate that impedance again and add 50 ohms to it. Make that result the denominator. in complex mathematics, divide the denominator into the numerator, and take the absolute value of that result. That is standing wave ratio. You do that on pencil and paper. If you just finished the course in complex mathematics, that's going to keep you busy for 5 minutes. With the Smith chart, you can get that answer in about 5 seconds. That gives you some idea of how valuable a Smith chart is. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, KTYIW, the TechNet.
Okay, you brought up a very good point. This is K2KEY. You said that the reading, the magnitudes, and all off the handheld antenna analyzers. Let me warn you about that. I've had this out with AEA, and I've experienced the same problem with an MFJ I've tried, and I've tried the antenna analyzer. If you'll notice on the edge of your Smith chart, it says wavelength towards generator. For some reason, when you've got an antenna, and I'll tell you basically why I think it happens. If you have an antenna that's within, say, approximately, oh, I don't know, I think, what did I measure it within, say, about, if you read along that where it says wavelength, along there to where it says 0.1. If it falls, the reactance, something in that arc, somewhere in that arc. I don't want to get too much into this wavelength business at this point right now, because I don't want to confuse people too much more now with the Smith chart. We can get into that some other time, maybe next week and all. But if it falls within that, these handheld analyzers are many times ambiguous. They'll drive you crazy. They do not produce an accurate answer. Let me let it drop, and I'll tell you why. Because when I looked at it, like, for instance, on the graphic displays that, like, are on the AEA and the Antenna Smith analyzer, if you look at the graphic display, if that curve, you see it coming down to so-called the point of where we open up, in other words, you can open up the bandwidth of what you're looking at. In other words, you can either go to zero, in other words, just looking at that one frequency. But if you want to look at the bandwidth of the antenna, you can open it up to sweep. And if you don't see that as a linear, it doesn't come down linear. Sometimes you see it's got bumps, curves. In other words, it doesn't look classically like the one in the advertisement, you know, as they show it to you in the magazine. It has a tendency then to mess it up. It confuses it. And in talking to AEA engineer who happens to know there, he says, remember, this is not a kilobuck instrument that you're buying. They do, we have ones that are better, but you're going to spend 4 or 5 times more to be able to resolve, you know, better readings. So, a word of caution. That's why I gave you an experiment that is a little bit more insight to more or even help confirm what you're seeing. This is why I did this pick, over.
Very fine, Mel. If I understand you correctly, what I think you're saying is that the AEA and MFJ and similar units throughout the area of a Smith chart for all the various kinds of impedances that your antenna can give you, when measured at the input end of your transmission line in the shack, that there are certain regions of that Smith chart where the voltage is too small or the phase is very difficult to measure, where the machine may not give you a good answer. And you've got a couple of choices in that case. You can sweep to a slightly different frequency, or you can put a certain, a slightly different length of cable, a random length of cable, on the transmission line and take the measurement again. Because even if you've added another 8th wavelength of transmission line and it's moved you to a different spot on the Smith chart, as long as the antenna analyzer can give you a nice, clean reading in that spot, it's very easy for you to mathematically take out that 8th wavelength of cable by swinging that circle a little bit counterclockwise, the right amount. 8th wave happens to be 90 degrees on the Smith chart, 90 degrees physical. When you sweep 360 degrees physically on the Smith chart, you're electronically sweeping 180 degrees. I know that's a little bit confusing. There's a 2-to-1 ratio. And one way to look at that is really what's going on is the RF signal is going through a certain length of cable on the way out the transmission line toward your antenna, and it's got a certain amount of cable it's going through the second time when the signal bounces as standing wave ratio and comes back. So your signal has been through the cable twice. That's part of the reason why there's this 2-to-1 ratio. So every time you want to move electronically an eighth wave, you're going to mechanically move less than that on the Smith chart because of this 2-to-1 ratio. But so you could put a length of cable you know about in there to where the machine reads correctly, and then mathematically you can take it back out to know what the reading would have been if your antenna analyzer could have handled that position. I wonder if they suggested that as a possible workaround, Mel. K2KUI, K2IW on the TechNet.
WH2CDL with a comment.
Mel first, and then Andy. Go ahead, Mel.
Yes, now here's the disclaimer. I'm talking to AEA and had quite a conversation with them at the time. He sent me, he says, a disclaimer that they send out when people do question, as you just mentioned, Dick. And here's the disclaimer that they give you with the instrument. After the resistive and the reactive component, I'm quoting, after the resistive and the reactive component of a load has been determined, the VSWR is measured again with the capacitive reactance. In other words, X of C is equal to or greater than X of L, placed in series with the load. If the resulting VSWR is less than the original VSWR, the reactance of the load is inductive. If the resultant VSWR is greater than the original VSWR, then the reactance is capacitive. That's the quote I got from them. That's the disclaimer that they send with the instrument over.
Okay, before I pass it back to Andy, I think I see what's going on here. It turns out that if you're trying to make an accurate set of sampling probes, that's the way a real $20,000 network analyzer works. It has very high frequency sampling probes that are able to measure amplitude and phase angle. But that's an extremely expensive structure to make them broadband and accurate. What I think each of these antenna analyzers have done is they've done the poor man's equivalent. They've got an internal switch that switches in a capacitor to the load. And if the VSWR gets better, it says, aha, we used to be capacitors. It used to be inductive. And if it gets worse, we used to be capacitors. So in other words, they're measuring phase angle, whether or not it's positive or negative phase angle, so to speak, by way of this very simple switching in a capacitor technique, which is a hell of a lot cheaper way of doing it than to really put in an extremely broadband phase measuring network. That's what I think I'm hearing. Very crafty. That's part of how they were taking a $20,000 instrument and bringing it down to a few hundred dollars. Andy, WA2CDL? Boy, we're looking forward to when the machine is back in the net mode. And go ahead with your question. K2RIW on the TechNet.
A minute, Andy. I'll let you make one more comment, and then you can take it.
Go ahead, Bill.
They do not give this. They suggest you add it. In other words, they're telling you to confirm it, the inductance or the reactor, the capacitive reactance in, to confirm it. It's not part of the instrument to confirm your reading, Dick, over.
Okay, I misunderstood. That's what I thought they had done. Still interesting information. Andy, you got it.
Okay, very good. Very interesting discussion on Smith charts here. And the repeater will be back to normal shortly. Thanks for being patient with this. I just want to mention, if to my surprise, anyone didn't know this, I at one of the flea markets where I had my tune-up table, I measured the level, the RF level, emitting from two side-by-side MFJ antenna analyzers, and to my surprise, one was putting out plus 10 dBm on a specific frequency on HF, the other one was putting out minus 30 dBm on the exact same frequency. And I said, if I didn't look at that level, I wouldn't even notice the difference. Now, the problem is that I see, if you just happen to have a lossy line that's pretty long, even though it's minus 30 is still a healthy signal to some extent, I would think it's possible to get a false reading because the signal being lower in level, by the time it reaches the end and travels back, like you said, Dick, it may not give you the right SWR reading because the level is different than what it's supposed to be. And that's and I was surprised to see those two readings being that much of a difference. That's a plus 10 to minus a 40 dB difference between two identical analyzers. Dick, back to you.
I'm in.
That's amazing. Two identical network analyzers on the exact same frequency, 40 decibel difference in power output. That sounds like an error. Do you believe both of them were in full operation, Andy? Andy first, go ahead.
W2VL repeater.
Well, as far as these are the MFJ antenna analyzers I'm mentioning. The model 259 or 269, the one that measures reactance as well as resistance, you know, the chase factor as well as resistor factor and everything else, the one that I think Mel's talking about. These are relatively new units, and apparently one was bad. But you wouldn't know unless you measured the level coming from it. One was seemed to be good. I think in the specification they tell you what the level coming out of the analyzer should be. And one was obviously incorrect. So it's good to measure the level to see how much is actually coming out. Especially under those conditions, I think no one wants to make a comment. But Dick, I'll give it back to you.
What should KB2LQN here again?
World recognized. Andy, what would have been very interesting is that if you took a T connector, whether it's type N or UHF, doesn't matter, put in a pair of your 50 ohm dummy loads on the two tips of that T connector, then take the common port of the T connector and plug it into that antenna analyzer, each one of them. A good one would read 2 to 1 standing wave ratio, the one with the plus 10 dBm of power output. The one with the minus 30 dB, which is 40 dB weaker, I'm of the opinion it's not going to be able to read that 2 to 1 standing wave ratio. That would have been a very interesting test to do. Back to you, Andy, first.
Yes, that makes sense, but under those conditions, I didn't do that test. But I did mention that there's a problem because the level is just too low, especially under these extreme conditions that I'm mentioning. All right, I just thought I'd throw that into the mix. Because it could be, it could give you a false reading for sure. And I know you agree with that. All right, back to you. I'm going to sign out because I got a couple of things to take care of. And we're still working on the repeater, but I got a number of things to do. Back to you, Dick. Keep up the good work, WHCDL.
Andy, that second antenna analyzer, the one with the minus 30 dBm signal, was it being brought to you because the owner thought it wasn't working correctly?
Actually, yes. This was a while back. I believe he said there was a problem. He wasn't sure if it was working properly. Just wasn't sure.
Sounds right. Okay, Mel, the next person with a question. Go ahead, Mel, or comment.
Okay, in talking to the manufacturers, I won't mention the name, they said 10% off on their instrument is on the average. That is why I came up with this idea of what I just outlined, to check your instrument this way. and get an idea what is going on, because I guarantee you, I'll tell you, because I've used a number of them, they are very, gee, it's amazing how they vary. And in fact, like I say, if the magnitude is anywhere between 0 and 0.1 of the generator, it will give you, in most cases, I have not found, let's put it this way, an accurate reading. In comparing it to a really a good instrument, you will find that there's going to be quite a variation. And the only way, that's why I gave basically this idea of using the Smith chart, really to give you a real insight into how good your instrument is and, you know, how much you can really trust what it's reading, Dick, over.
Yeah. Even on really high quality, $50,000 type vector network analyzers, which I've used in the past, you have to spend another $8,000 if you want the Cadillac version of the calibration kit. That consists of a set of known high quality 50 ohm terminations, usually one with a male connector, one with a female connector, as well as a pair of short circuits and open circuits, as well as a through connector. And when you go through the calibration procedure, you take your cables that are used for testing purposes coming out of the front panel of the instrument, and then you connect them on the through connector, and then as you go through the calibration procedure, it says on the J1 connector, put on the short circuit, put on the open circuit, put on the good termination, and press the button saying you've done it, and it takes a whole series of readings and so on. And it goes into a very complicated procedure. So even on the zillion-dollar vector network analyzer, Cadillac version, made by my two favorite brand names are Rode & Schwartz and Agilent, even on those, to be sure what's happening, you need a calibration kit. Therefore, when you've got one of these less expensive antenna analyzers, it would behoove you to start off with a 25-ohm resistor, a 50-ohm resistor, a 100-ohm resistor, a pair of terminations on a T connector, and so on, and see how the machine reads across the frequency region. You're doing your own calibration, so to speak. And if you know in certain frequencies and certain phase angles, it reads 5% or 8% high, and you can take that back out, you can drastically increase the accuracy of what you're doing. Let's see what Walt would like to ask. KB2LQN, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
You took half the comments right out of my mouth. I was going to ask about that calibration, because I have one of those meters, and I was going to say, hey, it takes 8 batteries, double A's, and let me tell you, if 2 or 3 are out, that'll knock your whole calibration of the meter way off. So those batteries have got to be fresh, and who knows when it was calibrated last. That's a very big problem there. Meanwhile, getting back to this, you mentioned taking the reading at the antenna point in your shack. I was wondering whether or not you take a reading right at the antenna, if you could hook up a small piece of cable to it, whether that would be more advantageous as far as getting a correct reading, and then afterwards you can see whether or not you're losing a lot of this in a lot of this radiation on your line going through the antenna from your shack.
Yeah, there's a bunch of yeses and nos to that question, as I see it, Walt. If you really want the simplest, fastest answer of the exact impedance of your antenna, putting your instrumentation right at the antenna, of course, is the best way to do it. And you'd like to make it an in-situ measurement. In other words, the antenna is mounted at its altitude where it's going to be used. And you climb the tower, open up that connector, put your instrumentation, and make the measurement. And assuming that the presence of your body is not seriously affecting the antenna, on an 80-meter dipole, that would absolutely be true. But if you're standing in front of your 432 Yagi antenna, yeah, your body is going to make an interference. That's one set of measurements. To make the measurement in the shack also has value, because now you're again feeding it under working conditions. Rarely do you operate with your transmitter up at the top of the tower. You're doing it at the input of the feed line in the shack. So that's another piece of valuable information. While you're up at the top of the tower, if through your handy talkie you're telling your assistant in the shack to turn on and off the 1 watt transmitter right now, while you go through your bird watt meter at the top of the tower into a dummy load, you can find out what is the insertion loss at all your favorite frequencies of your piece of transmission line. Once you know the insertion loss of your transmission line, either because you know you've just freshly, let me drop.
W2VL repeater.
Good evening. The time is 10 o'clock.
You know you freshly installed that cable. You know that the weather hasn't had a chance to operate on it yet. And the manufacturer tells you that the length of cable of that brand name and that model number is going to have 1.5 dB of insertion loss. Therefore, you can take all of your readings in the shack and subtract back out the 1.5 dB of loss to know what the real reading would have been at the top of the tower. Or conversely, you're at the top of the tower with good instrumentation, and somebody is feeding your transmitter at the bottom of the tower, you're talking to them with a handy-talkie, and you're measuring the real insertion loss of your cable. One way or the other, to crank out the loss of the cable is, in theory, very doable, and you don't have to make the measurement right at the antenna. So there's advantages of each way of doing it. The slight, even though you know the loss of the cable, and you think you know the length of the cable, calibrating that back for what measurement you measured in the shack versus what it means at the top of the tower, that's doable, but you pick up a little bit of error in the process for a bunch of reasons. One, the reflected signal from the top of the tower got a little bit weaker because it's been through the cable twice. And as the signal gets weaker into your antenna analyzer, the accuracy tends to degrade. So, on a rainy day, I don't think I'd like to climb the tower just to get a slightly more accurate reading. I think the reading in the shack, most of the time, if you're smart enough, is good enough. That's my opinion on that one, Walt. Back to you, Walt. KQLIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. But I don't have it on a tower. Like I said, I can reach it from a deck in the backyard, and I can unscrew it and check it that way and just put a small cable attached to the MFJ-259 and go from there. But, yeah, and if you're using good cables, I have a 9913 Belden, so we're not talking lousy cables, but you never know. There could be a bend or a kink or something in it that could be interfering, but so far, so good. That's it. That's my comment for the evening. Thank you so much. Give me 2LQN here.
You being as much of a scientist as you are, Walt, is another thing you can do, particularly where your antenna is so easy to get on the back deck of your house. You can make a measurement at the antenna at your various frequencies, connect the feed line, then make the measurement in the shack at the input end of the feed line, and correlate the two, and make sure the mathematics works out correctly. It's a beautiful learning curve of how to crank out the cable, whether you do it mathematically or on your Smith chart or whatever. So you can set yourself up a beautiful instruction class, so to speak, on cranking out the cable, the insertion loss, and the delay line phase length of your cable. So, Mel, are we all going to become proficient at Smith charts as we go through the next two lectures? Are we going to get a certificate saying that we are Smith chart mavens? KQKEY, KQIW in the TechNet.
That's why I basically came up with this simple tutelage, because if you do it step by step like I went through it, I think you get a little bit better insight into it. The problem is, the point is, with the method like you just mentioned, by using substitutes that you've known, like they do in the Killer Buck instruments, where they have these everything, of course, to you know, to the National Bureau of Standards, everything is, you know, traceable. But my method basically is the, you know, the 2 cent method, by using just resistance. But the idea of this is to confirm at least that the instrument that you have is somewhat within accuracy, or how much to, you know, how much you can, you know, rely on it. Because just as Andy said, if the instrument is off that much and somebody just doesn't recognize it, they're going to be really, you know, completely, you know, mystified of what's happening to their antenna. So basically, you can confirm, basically, like you say, this and use even a QRP radio and put these different loads in there. And if you use the Smith chart, confirm what your instrument is doing. And I say, check the instrument, because these instruments are easily damaged in many cases, or like the gentleman just said, Paul, batteries get a little weak. They become many times very ineffective, Dick, over.
Makes sense. And a voltage-controlled oscillator, which is the main source of signal inside of one of these antenna analyzers, it wants to see full voltage for its B+, and it also is probably doing some kind of a fancy voltage divider network off of its battery in order to feed the control voltage into the voltage-controlled oscillator to make it go to the right frequencies. And as your batteries go below a certain critical voltage, your internal voltage regulators drop out, so to speak, no longer are regulating, and you're no longer in complete control. I'd like to believe that a well-designed instrument will light up a red light on the front panel, telling you that you're below nominal supply voltage, therefore the readings are unreliable. Good instruments will tell you when they're unreliable. Some good instruments, when you first turn them on, go through an internal calibration procedure, which does some rudimentary testing to make sure that each of the functions are operational. If it's got a good microprocessor, setting up the right kind of a subroutine to do that is not too difficult. I'd like to believe that some of these AEA and MFJs hopefully are doing something like that. When it comes to the really fancy network analyzers, let me drop. The really fancy ones don't just have two input and output connectors. They've got four input and output connectors. That's called a four-port network analyzer. On those machines, you can put four-port hybrids on them, and it measures all possible combinations of input and output on those four ports of your device on the test. So it measures, ordinarily, the forward transfer characteristic is called S21. Scattering matrix sub-2-1, that's forward, and reverse is S-1-2, backwards the way you and I would have labeled it. We would have called 1-2 forward and 2-1 backwards. Well, they did it the other way around. But on a four-port network analyzer connected to a four-port device of the test, you can be measuring S-2-1, S-3-1, S-4-1, S-3-2, S-3-3, S-4-4, and so on. All of those have meaning. And all of them are vectors as a function of frequency. They've all got a magnitude and a phase angle, or a real and a reactive component. And if you start studying matrix math and you start manipulating all these numbers to find out what's really going on, and they'll tell you the quality of your directional coupler, the isolation of your hybrid, the amount of performance you're getting out of your circulator, and so on. So you can have a lot of fun with these things. When people first found out, 30 or so years ago, that you could accurately measure phase angle at RF frequencies, that was a bit of a mind blower. But that was the beginning of network analyzers. You can now buy from an American company network analyzers that will precisely measure to the nearest fraction of a degree of phase and the nearest very small fraction of a decibel of amplitude. They can make those measurements up to 110,000 megacycles, 110 gigahertz. And if you buy the machine that's made in France, you can go to 350 gigahertz. To make phase angles measurements at those frequencies, considering back in the days when making a phase measurement at 14 megacycles was considered very, very difficult 30 years ago, you can see that we've come a long way. But once you've got amplitude and phase, in theory, you've got it all. And you can really figure out what is the exact impedance versus frequency of any device on the test, what is the forward transfer characteristic, the reverse transfer characteristic, the input visoir, the output visoir, the gain, the loss, all of those numbers. That's what a network analyzer tells you. and properly used, the graphs coming out of that machine are extremely valuable to tell you whether or not the device you're measuring and the device you're designing is doing the right job. And
long wind is... Repeater, time out, 3 seconds.
And I was starting to say, and how to make it better once you know that data. Anybody got any further questions or comments on all of the above? Give me and Mel your call letters and name right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, that's K2KY, one last one.
Mel recognized. Anyone else?
Automatic control operator change over.
The machine says we're now out of the net mode. You got it, Mel.
Okay, one last comment. One other way that they suggested in talking to AEA is, I think I alluded to this a little bit last week, is making a return loss measurement. Now, you can do this with, I've done it with, you want to use a little bit more of a commercial instrument, but you don't have to go that far. You can make a simple device called a hybrid combiner. And by that, you will get your return loss, your RL reading. And that, you can compare also your RL and a little simple mathematics. But with the RL, you will be able to actually transfer it over to SWR. And again, give you another way of confirming the accuracy of your handheld antenna analyzer. Take over.
Yep. I'd like to do that that hybrid test as a confirmation. I'd also like to use my real transmit powers into a Bird watt meter, measure forward and reverse power, interpret that into standing wave ratio, and hopefully all these instruments will come to very close to the same set of measurements that agree with each other. If not, if you've got three instruments in the shack and two of them agree and one of them is crazy, usually it tells you the crazy one has got something wrong, and it's time to start applying corrective action or analysis of what's going on inside of him. Standards and traceability and accuracy and resolution, oh, you can have a grand old time with these terms. The most accurate thing that mankind ever measures, believe it or not, is frequency. The National Bureau of Standards will tell you the accuracy with which their WWV broadcast stations, how accurate was the signal transmitted by them on a particular day. They can give you that reading to the nearest 14 decimal places, one part in 10 to the 14, which is the equivalent of something like 1 second of accuracy in 3 billion years, if that was a clock. If that was the oscillator on your clock, they can measure the accuracy of 1 second in 3 billion years. When it comes to measuring standing wave ratio, if we amateurs get it to the nearest 5%, as far as I'm concerned, we're home free. That's approximately one part in 10 to the 1, as opposed to one part in 10 to the 14, what the NBS can do. So, we're a little shy by 13 orders of magnitude. K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2JJ with a comment.
Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, good evening, Dick, and all aboard here. You guys got me curious. I just made a measurement on my MFJ-269 analyzer using the Hewlett-Packard 436A power meter, and I came up with plus 6.25 dBm output. So I guess there's a wide range on those.
It may also determine, depend on what frequency you were set at. I wonder if it puts out the same amount of power on 20 meters, 10 meters, 15 meters, 80 meters, so to speak. By the way, remember I was giving everyone a little bit of a tease before as to the repair of the Hubble Space Telescope. One of the members of the Astronomical Society of Long Island, of which I'm a member, put a letter on there today, October 27th. This is from Joe Rayo, by the way. You probably know him as one of the weather men that uses, that you hear sometimes on local broadcast stations. Joe Rayo has a friend that works at NASA headquarters, and from there, they published the following report, which maybe we haven't found it on our normal website yet. It says, NASA Administrator Michael Griffin will announce on Tuesday, October 31, a decision on a space shuttle mission to service the Hubble Space Telescope. The announcement is scheduled for 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time during an agency-wide employee meeting from NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, Greenbelt, Maryland. The event will be live on NASA TV and also on www.nasa.gov. The news conference will follow a Goddard... A news conference will follow at Goddard, also broadcast live on NASA TV at 12:45 p.m. Questions from reporters will be taken from NASA's Kennedy Space Center, Florida, Johnson Space Center, Houston, NASA headquarters. Media who want to attend the news briefing must contact Goddard Public Affairs to arrange accreditation and access to the center. Reporters should call either Ed Compion or Susan Hendricks at so-and-so phone number. Next week's decision will follow a final evaluation meeting at NASA headquarters, which took place on Friday, where senior agency officials will present their recommendations to Griffin on the feasibility of servicing the mission. Let's see what else it says here. If the mission is a go, there will be a news report, there will be a news conference at 2:30, and another one at 3:30, and another one at 5 o'clock. So there's a whole series of media news conferences that will take place if the decision is positive and it's a go. And so I am guessing the decision has already been made, but we're not going to hear about it until 10 o'clock, Tuesday morning, October 31st, Halloween Day. I wonder if you've heard about any of this, Paul, WS2N, if you happen to be there. WS2N, if you are, K2RIW on the TechNet. Wait for the beep. Maybe Paul got called away, and maybe Paul thought we forgot about him. So, for us Hubble huggers, this could be good news. Up till now, I thought they had essentially closed the door and said that Hubble is going to be sacrificed. It's too risky to go there to repair it. But because of the new organizations and the new safety procedures that have been installed on the space shuttle, I'm hoping the answer is yes, that they're going to go there. Now, for those who ask the question, you know the answer is no. You cannot discover that you're at the Hubble and you've got some damage to the heat tiles on the leading edge of the wing of the space shuttle, and therefore you're going to go over to the International Space Station as a lifeboat and in order to do the repair. That's not possible. The procedure by which you get to the Hubble and the procedure by which you get to the International Space Station are very different flight paths. You cannot go from one to the other. You have to take off from the ground with the objective of going to that particular target and no other target. To reorient yourself to a new altitude and a new inclination angle in space, you don't have that option. There's nowhere near enough fuel on board to do that. The amount of fuel you're lacking on board to do that is wrong by at least 10 to 1. Anybody with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW on the TechNet. Okay, I'm going to turn it back to you, Mel. Do you have anything else do you think we should cover tonight? K2KUI. K2IW is the TechNet.
So I'll listen to your, Twitter on the net.
Okay, the person who just spoke, I'm sorry, I doubled with you. Please repeat your message, K2LIW.
W2.
Yeah, the
call
is W2LIW. I have a question from you, not pertaining directly to the subject I've been talking about. It's been interesting listening to you, but I'll wait till the net is over. I'll catch you when it's some place you may be somewhere, because it's pretty tough talking on a repeater, where I'm listening to it from. I'm getting heterodyne from the one up in Connecticut, so it's really doing a pretty bad job on the time.
Okay, if it is working right now, let's give it a go. W2ONY. Start off with your name and then follow with your question. My name is Vic.
I'm away at ONY from RYY.
Okay, Whiskey 2 Romeo Yankee Yankee. Sorry about that. Go right ahead. Give me your name and proceed with your question.
Okay, name is Joe. And this has to do with satellite, receiving and how they rate amplifier sensitivity. Well, actually, I guess it more pertains to noise figure, which is probably right up your alley. I understand this stuff is rated in kilobits. When you get up into working with that kind of equipment, you no longer rate the amplifiers. They're no longer rated in decibels. You start rating stuff in kilobits. And I've never really quite understood the relationship between one to the other. I know kilobit is a measurement of temperature, but maybe you could just explain further.
Yes, I can. I used to know your brother very well when he was active in ham radio. I'm now placing you. It turns out that kelvins give you a much higher accuracy. You're about to ask why. If I was doing nothing but room temperature measurements with laboratory test equipment where everything is at 290 degrees Kelvin, which is roughly 22 degrees centigrade, which is something like 64 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the standard reference temperature at which the IEEE says that noise figure is defined. If I was doing nothing but room temperature measurements, measuring noise figure in decibels would be perfectly okay. However, you take a good ground station where the antenna is aimed at cold sky, looking up at a satellite, where the background temperature on a good day could be 3 degrees Kelvin, whereas your laboratory test equipment is almost 300 degrees Kelvin. That's a 20 decibel difference. When you get into a cryogenic system, that means colder than room temperature, an antenna that's aimed at cold sky is a cryogenic antenna. That antenna aimed at cold sky is, in theory, 20 decibels more sensitive than the antenna that's used terrestrially, where it's looking at hot Earth. If you've got a good enough low noise amplifier on that amplifier. If I was measuring an amplifier that was being used in that environment, 3 degrees Kelvin, let me drop for a second. Let's assume now that I've got a perfect low noise amplifier, and my antenna is looking at the background temperature left over from the Big Bang, 3 degrees Kelvin. So I've got a 3 degree Kelvin system. Assume my antenna is ideal. I've got a certain signal-to-noise ratio when I listen to that satellite that's out there in space in the main lobe of my antenna. If I now convert from my ideal low-noise amplifier to a low-noise amplifier with 3 degrees Kelvin of equivalent temperature, my system now would be 6 degrees Kelvin. 3 degrees is coming from the antenna, 3 degrees is coming from the preamplifier, degrees Kelvin adds directly. That would be a 6 degree Kelvin system. Believe it or not, that signal that I used to be listening to with that satellite, because I went from a 3 degree system to a 6 degree system, that signal to noise ratio just degraded by 3 dB. I got a 3 dB loss in signal to noise ratio by changing 3 degrees Kelvin. You go to the chart, and 0 versus 3 degrees Kelvin is something like 0.01 dB of noise figure difference. When you get cryogenic, decibels of noise figure no longer behave in a linear manner. Only degrees Kelvin do. So, when it comes to Earth stations and cryogenic systems, you're slowly getting a little bit of an idea as to why degrees Kelvin are very desirable, very linear, and tell you something you wouldn't know by knowing dB of noise figure. If I'm trying to measure 0.01 or 0.05 dB noise figure, and I'm using a machine which has an accuracy of 0.5 dB, half a dB of accuracy, obviously I can't do it. But if I've got a good machine that can measure degrees Kelvin, I stand a chance. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. Now I know who you are. K-2-R-I-W. You got it, Joe.
Right, I should have just signed that and said, hey, it's Richie's brother, then you remember who I was. Yeah, I thought you quite a... quite a few times, some on the net, some off, so forth. But, okay, it's very interesting. Now, the reason I ask is I've heard, I guess, some things, the noise for your listeners, like say, like it's 136 degrees, for example, like a satellite equipment, for example, or something like that. And I'm not sure what that references itself to directly. Maybe I'm just talking, I didn't get the rest to really understand completely what was going on.
Okay, get out your pencil and paper, Joe, and I'm going to give you a formula. If you want to convert from degrees Kelvin of equivalent noise figure of a low noise amplifier, and you want to convert it back into decibels of noise figure, here's the formula. 10 times the log, open parentheses, T divided by 290 plus 1, close parentheses. So in other words, you take the temperature they've just quoted to you, divide it by 290, add 1 to the result, take log of that, multiply it by 10. That converts from degrees Kelvin, T is temperature, that converts from degrees Kelvin into decibels of noise figure. Now you know the relationship between the two. If you want real bad, I can give you the inverse formula. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, I don't need really to light on because I've actually seen the mobile stationary someplace just listening to you. But very interesting. I'll see if I can remember that. I guess I could look that up someplace too, but it seems easier getting you because you just Mr. RF out there.
Well, one way of looking at it is that you know that the reference temperature is 290. So once you take your temperature, you're going to divide by 290. But whatever number you're going to take the log of, it's got to be a number greater than unity. Otherwise, your log is going to come out negative. And you don't want to deal with negative noise figure. They don't exist. That's why you add 1 to it. So your temperature, whatever it is, you're going to divide by 290, the reference temperature. That result, you're going to add 1.0 to it. Then you're going to take the log of that and multiply by 10. So once you know the process and why you're doing those individual steps, you should be able to re-derive this formula mentally, even though you don't have to get the ability to write it in pencil paper. And you signed into the TechNet without a pencil and paper in hand? Shame on you. I'm having fun with you, Joe. Back to you, Joe.
Oh, okay. And 290 is the temperature, what's the relationship Kelvin? Now, I guess, what did you say before? What was 22 degrees C in Kelvin?
Okay. Now that I've got my calculator in front of me, I think you said you've got 138 degree Kelvin amplifier. 138 divided by 290. 290 is the reference temperature that the IEEE has set by which all noise figure measurements will be made. Okay, I did the division. I add 1, multiply by, take the log, multiply by 10. It's interesting. 138 degrees Kelvin of amplifier is a 1.69 dB noise figure. 138 degrees Kelvin, by that formula, is a 1.69 dB noise figure. I think that's what you're asking. Back to you, Joe.
Close. Okay. Yeah, I think that my record was like 136, but that certainly makes it easy to understand. So the lower the Kelvin number, the lower the noise, basically the lower the noise figure, the result, the amplifying system you're talking about.
Absolutely, and the lower the number, the better, which is opposite of most measurements. Most measurements, like if it's power output, the higher the better, but in noise figure, the lower the better. If I had an amplifier that was running 77 degrees Kelvin, which happens to be the boiling temperature of liquid nitrogen, it's very close to 1.0 dB noise figure. If I had a really high quality amplifier, which was cooled with liquid helium, which I think is somewhere around 11 degrees Kelvin. 11 degrees Kelvin divided by 290, add 1 to it, take log, multiply by 10. That's a 0.16 dB noise figure. So, and what's crazy about these numbers is that when you get into cryogenic systems, an antenna looking at cold sky, it is possible to make a tenth of a decibel of difference in the noise figure and get a 3 dB difference in signal-to-noise ratio, simply because only degrees Kelvin behave in a linear manner in a cryogenic system. Decibels do not. Decibels behave in a linear manner if and only if everything is at room temperature. But once you've got that ground station looking at cold sky, ain't nothing at room temperature anymore. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, the whole subject is very interesting. I've always been fascinated about it by it because it has to do, in itself, it's just very interesting. Obviously, the lower the noise figure of the device you're trying to listen to in the gain of the dish, the means you're going to hear more that's out there when aimed at a particular point in space. If that's what you happen to be looking at. But, I guess also ultimately reach a certain level, a certain threshold. You can't make the amplifier you can't get any more gain in any dish, and the amplifier can't have any lower of a noise figure. You just reach a certain point, and that's all you're going to get. And what would you do in a case like that? Have a couple more stations together?
You would think there is a sound barrier, so to speak, on ground station performance. Uh-huh. You can always make the preamplifier lower in noise figure. If my preamplifier was 10 degrees Kelvin, very difficult to achieve. And if I'm smart enough with cryogenic cooling and choose the right GESFET and HEMFET and indium phosphide, gallium arsenide, field effect transistors, you pull out all the stops. You can make an amplifier 5 degrees Kelvin instead of 10 and pick up a possible 3 dB signal-to-noise ratio improvement. On top of that, the antenna itself, I'll admit there's a gain maximum you can't go beyond if you've got a certain diameter of dish. But how strong are the side lobes? Are those side lobes looking at hot earth? Therefore, the bottom line report card for your ground station is not gain, it's not temperature. It's gain to temperature ratio. You may not be able to squeeze more gain out of the antenna, but you may be able to correct the surface error bumps or make a better feed horn so that the back lobes of the antenna looking at hot earth are smaller. Therefore, the temperature of the antenna goes down, even though the gain didn't change, and you got better signal-to-noise ratio of the satellite you're listening to. There are ground stations out there, Joe, where people have spread copper screening on the ground under the dish to make sure that the back lobes of the dish that used to see hot earth are now looking at a metallic reflecting surface that's reflecting cold sky back into the back end of the dish, if you know what I mean. And they've made improvements. There are ground stations that have got wire lapping spread on the ground around the dish to improve the gain-to-temperature ratio. But the bottom line, when you and I enter into a contract to build a good ground station, is what is the G over T that determines whether or not you get the premium payment? Back to you, Rich, K2LIW on the tech desk.
Okay, I copied most of it. Some of that was cut out, but I'm going to repeat it. But it's difficult for me to talk to you on the... I'm listening on dot 85 because the one in Connecticut is almost the same as Cypress Bank. It'll always completely wipe this one out. So part of that I didn't catch. Sorry.
Okay, Joe. You're a guy who has the technology where you can put a Yagi antenna on your house, aim it at this repeater, and steer the null at Connecticut, therefore improve the signal-to-noise ratio. You have the technology. Back to you, Joe.
I know. The only thing I don't have is a 2-meter antenna up in the house or a 2-meter transceiver to go with it.
Yeah, but a guy of your resources, you have the ability to buy all of the above. Okay, good luck with all of that jazz. Anybody with any further questions or comments on anything you've heard tonight, give me your call letters right now, KQIW on the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, I got a telephone call from one of the people that are listening on their scanner, And they said that it's very enlightening, this discussion that we had on the Smith chart. And I want to again emphasize only one more thing, that hams many times have instruments, and we don't check the accuracy of them. We will, you know, put them away for a long period of time and take it out and then measure the same antenna and say, oh, boy, boy.